Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to The Art Detective with me, Dr. Yanina Ramirez. I'm an Oxford art historian, a broadcaster and a writer, but for the purposes of this podcast, I am your chief investigator of images. I'm joined today by a dear friend and a fellow York University graduate, I might add, which is something we have in common, Greg Jenner. Now, when I asked Greg how he wanted to be described, maverick, sex god, and man of the people, which obviously I agree with all of those. But for your day job, Greg, you do something a bit more, you know, applicable, which is that you're a public historian, aren't you? And most excitingly, the historical consultant on Horrible Histories, possibly the best historical TV making it out there. Have I described you accurately?
I think that's probably fair. I tend to use the phrase chief nerd to Horrible Histories for the kids. That's what they like to call me.
That means you're like uber nerd. You are beyond, you're on a level beyond nerdery.
Well, I've got a team of researchers, so I get to be king of the nerds, and I've got to, you know, people who help me out. But chief historical advisor. Yeah.
You have been in it as well, haven't you? I believe you were, you didn't have the crown, but you were one of William's men, weren't you?
I am William the Conqueror's dancing squire in chainmail in the King and Queen song. Because I did ballet as a kid, I think they were like, right, you can do some dancing. And it's surprisingly
hard. It's amazing. I've watched it so many times, it makes me laugh. But yes, yeah, so you are chief nerd, but a very amazing historian. You've written, well, your first book. Was it your first book, The Million Years in a Day?
Yeah.
That was incredible, and it did so well, didn't it?
It's been very lovely. It's, you know, it's when you write a book, you just sort of fear that no one will read it, or if they do read it, they will hate it. And I'm not sure which is more scary. But yeah, it seems to... people seem to quite like it, and it's been translated into lots of nice languages that are very exciting and baffling when you read them. You don't speak Slovenian.
I love seeing the cover pages that you post on Twitter, and it just, the idea that you write something and then it becomes unreadable by the author is just wonderful.
And also it's a slightly jokey book. It's got lots of sort of puns and it's sort of quite lighthearted and funny. And I just worry that how are they doing the puns in Bulgarian? So that's my main concern. But
you have to leave it up to the translators.
People from Turkey and Hong Kong and so on saying, you know, I read your book, it was really good. You go, oh, thanks so much. I have no idea if it's any good.
What you've read.
I don't speak. So it's a tough one. But, you know, it's lovely to see the book being read by people. So that is the big thing.
Okay. And you are working on a book about celebrity at the moment, aren't you? Which is a huge topic.
Yeah, it is surprisingly big, much bigger than I assumed. So that'll probably be about 3 to 3.5 years of work in total by the time I'm done with it.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, keep us posted in the meantime. But we are together to talk about something really exciting, something that we both love, the Bayeux Tapestry. So last week on Art Detective, I had a bit of a scoop. I managed to get to the launch of the Folio Society's new reproduction of the tapestry. It's incredible. So it's not the full 70 meters, but it's 49 meters. It's massive, and it's on a little tabletop, and you can scroll through, and it's absolutely perfect. It's like being in the company of the Bayeux Tapestry. So I managed to chat to them, but one of the things that came out of that was that really we only scratched the surface of this incredible artwork. And when I first told you about Art Detective, you said months and months and months ago, I'm going to do the Bayeux Tapestry. I'm going to do it. That's what I want to do. Why did you want to do it so badly?
Because, well, lots of reasons. I mean, obviously, I'm a medievalist by training, though, you know, everyone studies the Bayeux Tapestry at some point. But I just find it a really intriguing document because it's so ambiguous. And also, I'm half English and I'm half French. So I am acutely aware of the kind of sort of disagreements and biases going on in the artwork, because it's sort of, on one hand, you kind of go, well, this is a pro-French, pro-Norman piece of propaganda. And then there are moments where you think, well, hang on a minute, Harold's the good guy. So I really admire the artistic, it's a beautiful piece of embroidery. It's not a tapestry, it's an embroidery, as they're all, you know, we always bang on about. But I really like the politics of it. There's something quite subversive and a little bit naughty about the little running jokes that are going along the top and bottom of the frieze.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, this is the point for me where art meets history meets literature. It's that incredible object that sort of crosses the disciplinary divides. And as medievalists, Greg, we know this, don't we? You have to use every bit of information that's available to you. Otherwise, you don't have an awful lot to work with. So I think medievalists are sort of naturally disposed to be a bit more interdisciplinary. But the Bayeux tapestry, the fact it survives at all is really remarkable, isn't it? I mean, it's called the supreme achievement of the Norman Romanesque. And I suppose when we think of Romanesque, we tend to think of cathedrals, big architectural statements, or sculpture. But this is something quite fragile. It is absolutely amazing that it's not been burnt or destroyed or lost.
Yeah, and I mean, it's 70 metres in length, give or take, but only 50 centimetres roughly in height. So it's a strange shape and size. And, you know, when you think of a tapestry, you went to Hampton Court Palace, for example, those tapestries are wall hanging. They're big, they're rectangular, they cover the walls. This is a sort of frieze, and it's hand embroidered by a team of people, presumably. And you could sort of definitely see this having got lost at some point, or, as you say, someone catches fire to it accidentally with a candle. Or, I mean, we know it was used as a covering on a wagon in, like, the French Revolution, and you know, it very nearly ended up probably just being a bit of fabric that someone repurposed as a bit of a tarpaulin. So we're really lucky, along with the Book of Kells. I think this is one of the sort of great medieval treasures that sort of accidentally ended up being still with us, but kind of nearly lost it. So we're very lucky.
And also, it kind of teaches us about the robustness of a lot of these things. I mean, I'm sure you're the same, though. But when you're in museums or libraries and you're handling artifacts, or, you know, I did some programs on manuscripts where I had to be so reverential towards these things. At the end of the day, they're quite robust. The Book of Kells, but like a lot of early manuscripts, it was dunked in a cow's water trough because they thought that putting the sacred manuscript into the cow's water would cure the cows of any diseases. And the fact that you can dunk a manuscript like that in and out of water, and yet we mustn't let our hair near to the vellum.
Yeah, it's, and that sort of thing of having to wear gloves on television. It's like, no, the gloves are like, you know, you're not meant to wear gloves because that inhibits your dexterity and you're more likely to rip a page.
I think one of the reasons as well that the tapestry survives is because it's got that wonderful story of the French beating the English. It's an amazing bit of propaganda that has managed to survive the test of time. And the fact that it was put up regularly within the cathedral, it sort of suggests that maybe they were, you know, within Normandy, this was something that they wanted to continue holding on to, and they repaired it and they looked after it. Because it's a great bit of English bashing, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously, as I think you might have mentioned in the previous podcast, Napoleon displays it in, I think, 1803, because that's when he's planning his great invasion of Britain. And this is his roadmap to success. This is what you do. You put your men in a boat, you put your horses in the boat, you get on the boat, you go across the channel, and suddenly you're invading a foreign nation. So he was trying
the King of England.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the remarkable thing about William's invasion, of course, which, you know, not to get sidetracked too much, but the odds of him succeeding are so low. And we just assume, take it as given, that he succeeded. Of course he did. You know, William the Conqueror was the King of England. We know this. But he had to get in a ship with thousands of men, 3,000 horses. You've got to feed them. You've got to clothe them. You've got to get across the dangerous seas. Then you've got to arrive. Then you've got to draw the English king into battle. Then you've got to beat him. Then you've got to take the country. It's a really difficult thing to do. So you can see why the Bayeux tapestry is so celebratory, but also why, in some regards, it's sort of needed. is that it's sort of trying to justify this real long shot that came off.
Yeah. And it was a long shot because, I mean, one of the themes that really comes through, I remember doing this for A-level history about whether William had any claim to the English throne at all. And if he does, it's tenuous at best, isn't it? Yeah. And what we see throughout this is, I suppose it's going back to earlier ideas of the spoils to the victor, really, because it's a huge program that he puts together. Like you say, here you see the documenting of all the weapons that are being made, the number of spears that are being lined up, the like you say, the wagons, the horses, the ships themselves, which are top-notch technology for their day.
Yeah.
All of that enterprise leads to success. So, yes, there's a sort of undertone of justifying that Harold gave his oath to William, that Edward didn't have an heir and William was a you know, bloodline. But actually, there's something more about it, isn't there, which is hard work pays off.
Yeah, exactly. Planning. It's all in the planning and the execution and the luck as well, of course, because, of course, he's holding the papal banner. He believes that God's on his side. You know, in a very religious 11th century mindset, this is God's will. And the fact that it's such a long shot and he still succeeds is just further proof that he was always in the right and that God has blessed his cause with victory. So, you know, you can see that it's a combination of religious fervor and political one-upmanship, but also an enormous logistical operation.
And in terms of where it's made, because I think this is one of the things you picked up on right at the beginning, there's a controversy, isn't there? Because on the one hand, we can definitely say, well, now I think we can definitely say that this was connected with Odo Thayer, that this is William's half-brother. He is put in charge of the county of Kent, but he also has this stronghold in Bayeux, and it's probably made around 1070, around the time that the big cathedral's being built there in the Romanesque manner. But the odd thing, of course, is that most scholars now agree it was made in England by female embroiderers in this style, Opus Anglicanum, that they've got really famous for, maybe in and around Canterbury. So right from the off, you've got a seeming a conflict between the conquerors trying to tell their story and the embroiderers sat there working day after day with these details, possibly adapting it to tell a slightly different story. What do you think?
I mean, that's the exciting thing, isn't it? This is what scholars have argued about for decades. I mean, the first thing to say, I think, is how do we know that it's made in England in Canterbury? Well, the evidence is good for this because, on the one hand, the names that are listed in the tapestry are English spellings. So that's the first thing. Eduardus is the Latin, yeah. Edward the Confessor. But more crucially, I think, is William is written as Wilhelm rather than the Norman version, Wilhelm. So you've got English orthography being used for names, which suggests the people doing it are using English spelling. And the other more impressive argument, I think, the one that really convinces for me, is that there are many borrowed images in the tapestry itself that have been nicked from other earlier medieval artistic depictions in manuscripts. And all of the key ones are from manuscripts that were held in the library in Canterbury. And one of the most famous ones is a manuscript that was given to St. Augustine by the Pope himself in 597, when he comes over and he Christianizes the Saxons and builds his first church in England. And this gospel has this very famous moment in it, which then turns up again in the Bayeux tapestry. So it suggests that actually the designer, whoever that person is, and the team putting it out there, who are, as we say, probably women, maybe nuns, they are looking at earlier inspiration in medieval manuscripts, but they're rummaging around the library, which means they're probably in Canterbury.
Yeah. Oh, yes. You see, you're an excellent art historian, Greg. You know, you need to become an art historian officially, full time. Because that's the thing, isn't it? It's about finding the sources, the evidence that's surrounding these people. They're not creating images in a vacuum. So no. So the scene that you're thinking of is that Last Supper scene, isn't it? That you see in the comic book frieze on the St. Augustine Gospel book. And then you see it reproduced as a feast in the middle. It's one of my favourite bits of the tapestry, actually, the idea that they're having a great big feast.
Yeah.
There's also, other hints as well.
But also Odo, where is Odo's position? He's in the same position where Jesus is in the original.
Exactly.
So Odo is sort of going, hey, I'm the figurehead here. I'm the most important person here, which lends weight to the idea that Odo has commissioned this and he is bigging himself up. And actually, he appears in the tapestry several times at key moments doing heroic things. So I think there's strong evidence to say that he has ensured that he comes out very well here.
He's in the Christ-like figure, exactly. Yeah. And there's something interesting about this object as well, because one of the remarkable things being a medievalist, you tend to study a lot of art that's got very, very clear Christian connections, were used in Christian settings, manuscripts, liturgical objects. This is a secular object. And that's a tricky word in the medieval period because everything is influenced by religious imagery, religious iconography. But it is telling a story of battle. It's just telling a story of kings, of courts, of royalty, and that makes it again a really unique survival. There's a lot in here that tells us about the time, isn't there? We can get information on fashion, on weaponry, on the facial hair. I presume you've picked up on the facial hair connection.
Well, I'm all about the facial hair because I'm a beardy man myself, and there's that sort of really interesting thing that the Normans and the Saxons, or the English if we want to call them English, are. Well, the Normans are sort of othered, or the English are othered, or rather there's a divide between them in how they wear their facial hair. The Normans don't have any facial hair,
Literally.
And in fact, they have very little hair on their heads as well. They shave the back of their head all the way up to the top of the skull. And then from there, they then have this sort of awful sort of front mullet, really. It's kind of like a like a really, really heavy fringe at the front. But the back is all shaved. And this, of course, is because they wear coifs. Male coifs up over the head when they ride, and your hair gets caught in it. It's a practical hairstyle, but it makes them look like really sort of scary militant guys who, you know, have got this really weird hairstyle. The Saxons,
they do look really odd. I mean, the thing is they're always presented in contrast to the Anglo-Saxons, who always look a bit folky with their facial hair.
They're sort of maybe they sort of play, you know, country songs in folk songs in the 70s or there's a sort of German porn star look going on as well, with some of them have got really big handlebar tashes. And the Normans shave their face as well, so that's, you know, the other thing is the Normans depilate, they shave, they have a very different aesthetic and a different interpretation of masculinity in terms of masculine beauty, masculine looks. They are, you know, the Saxons and Normans are equally violent when they need to be, but there is a very different aesthetic going on with male grooming.
And this is something I think that you pick up on in your book particularly, but actually it's interesting where we trace back the lines of the Normans, because the Normans are Norse men. They are descended from Vikings. And one of my bugbears is how the Vikings are miscast as these sort of brutal looking barbarians who run around with bits of bone sticking out of their beards, slaughtering people. But they were incredibly vain. Viking male graves, you know, we find all these preening utensils and they braided themselves. And actually, the way that you express yourself, it's the same today, but the way you express yourself through the way you dress and the way you present your hair, your facial hair, but also tattoos, all these things that are often lost through looking at burials, there's certain bits of evidence like the Bay of Tapestry that bring those things back to life. And it's really important because it is the defining look that separates people. If you're going to whack someone in a battle, if they've got a moustache, you might be on their side, so don't whack them. But it's actually an important part of structuring this military society, isn't it?
It absolutely is. I would say we have to be perhaps a little cautious of using the tapestry too much as a sort of archaeological record of exactitude. I think, because I make historical dramas as well, I've actually made a historical drama about 1066, Channel 4, several years ago. And one of the crucial things when you're making a historical drama is your characters need to look different. They need to have different hairstyles, different names. If you cast too many people who look the same, they're all roughly the same height, same hair color, same look, quite hard to tell them apart. And I wonder if the artists here in the tapestry have sort of gone, right, okay, how do we tell a Norman from a Saxon? All right, Saxons have tashes, Normans don't. And and maybe they have sort of created a bit of a broad brush approach in order to make things clearer. And actually, this is a sort of, this is artistic clarity rather than archaeological verisimilitude. So I wonder if we have to be a little bit careful in reading the tapestry as a pure representation of what people look like and their clothing, because of course there are things in the tapestry that slightly don't add up, like well, we know at this period in history round shields had sort of gone out of fashion really, but the Saxons were all using round shields. So again, you say, okay, is that a sort of deliberate differentiation, or are we saying the Saxons are a bit backwards and they're a bit kind of old worldy and they're using recycled kit, and ditto at a Norman kite shape shield, which is longer, at that point in history it didn't need to have a boss on it, which is that metal lump in the middle. You don't need those because that's not a vital part anymore. With the design of a kite shaped shield, you don't need the boss to hold it together. So is that simply a nice bit of artistic license? Is that something the artist has seen elsewhere in a different illustration, or were these bosses there in the shield?
You're right to caution against depending on it too heavily. And again, it's important to note that this is made after the events. The things that are being recorded, I mean, we haven't even said what's being recorded, but it is the run-up to 1066, the preparations, the battle itself. And then we're missing probably about a metre and a half at the end of the tapestry.
We're missing William's coronation.
Don't know what was on it.
Well,
William's coronation.
Yeah. I mean, you'd think so, wouldn't you? Because, of course, the whole point is about legitimizing William's reign, because this man is not just a foreign interloper, but he's a man who's known as William the Bastard. He was illegitimate. You know, he was a hard bastard as well. He was a violent guy, both meanings of the word. But, medieval society at this point gets less hung up on being rightful heir and all that, but he is a man who has sort of fought his way to dignity, and then he's come and invaded a whole huge kingdom of England with its long-held traditions, and in order to justify his new reign, he's having to put out this propaganda, put out these sort of the Doomsday Book or whatever, these various technologies of asserting power, because he is not, you know, he's not one of them. He's new, he's novel, he's foreign. And so the tapestry presumably culminates with a kind of glorious coronation in the new church of Westminster Abbey. Because we've seen all the way through the tapestry, these 75 scenes, give or take, that he is the rightful heir, the rightful owner of the throne, and that Harold is the bad guy who has stolen power. We think that that's apparently what we're being told. Now, you've mentioned earlier that actually there is some ambiguity going on, and this is where I get quite excited, because I think the tapestry has a sort of internal argument with itself about who is the bad guy, because there's lots going on in there.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. it's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
And this is where we're getting brought into the idea of the marginalia as well, because, again, I'm the same. I get so excited at the thought that there's hidden mysteries, hidden symbols in artworks like this. And, you know, when you're painstakingly embroidering day after day and you're using tiny little stitches, there is the temptation. It's the same with manuscript illumination. There is the temptation to add little details that might be missed at first glance, but on close inspection are there. And there is this relationship, isn't there, between the action that's taking place in the middle part of the tapestry and then these borders. So on the whole, they're usually decorative. And that, again, is a sign, I think, of the Anglo-Saxon, possibly a sign of the Anglo-Saxon heritage here, because we see a lot of birds, a lot of beasts, a lot of sort of foliate designs that, that we also see in manuscripts. But there's the odd occasional little hint at things, isn't there? So the ghost fleet, that's a particularly good one, isn't it?
Yeah, and the thing that I'm really into is the Aesop fables.
I bet, yeah.
They just, you know, because they, you know, as you say, if you're an artist and you're just there day after day, you know, I suppose part of it might be just like, I'm going to draw a cow. I'm bored. What can I draw? I'm running out of ideas. Oh, I'll do another winged lion.
Exactly.
I'm sure there's a sort of like, you know, just fill the space with whatever. But there are some deliberately political, by the looks of it, insertions which are speaking to Greek myth, or not necessarily myth, but the fables told by Aesop, who is a very sort of, in the Middle Ages, it becomes quite commonly well read. The stories are well known in the Middle Ages. And the Aesop fables are, of course, moral tales about, you know, doing right and doing wrong and being careful not to trust the wrong person and so on. And some of these fables seem to be in really interesting places in the tapestry, at really key scenes, you know, beneath the sort of crucial moments. You see these little Aesop fables, and it suddenly creates a meaning that maybe wasn't necessarily intended to be there by the main designer. Maybe the artists are adding little elements themselves, or maybe the designer built in ambiguity. You know, some of these are, you know, the one that leaps out for me is The Fox and the Crow.
Absolutely, yeah.
And the story of The Fox and the Crow, if I remember rightly, I haven't done Aesop since I was about 8 years old. I'm going to try and remember. I think the crow has stolen some cheese from a farmer's windowsill, goes up into the tree branch and is sitting there with the cheese in its mouth. And the fox, cunning fox, comes up and says, oh, you know, you're a lovely crow. But of course, crows have horrible voices. They can't sing as beautifully as other birds. And the crow goes, oh, hang on a minute, what are you talking about? I'm a beautiful singer, and opens its mouth to sing to prove the fox wrong. Cheese falls out, and the cunning fox gets its cheese. My first problem with this is I didn't realise that crows or foxes like cheese. I've always struggled with that. But the idea of the myth, of course, is that the cunning fox uses the vanity and pride of the crow against it to outfox it, to outwit it, takes its prize from it. But of course, when you think about it, the story starts with the crow stealing the cheese in the first place. It's not the crow's cheese to begin with, it's the farmer's cheese. And then the fox has stolen it from the crow and has done so with cunning and with, you know, snide, naughty ways. So we see this fox and the crow three times in the tapestry. And we see them crucially when Harold, his basically sworn an oath on holy relics to, by the look of it, support William's support for the crown of England. But then, strangely, the third time you see it, the crow has the cheese again. So they put the cheese back in the crow's mouth, and then Harold is sailing back to England. So I wonder if maybe the artist there is saying, look, you know, cheese is the crown of England. The crow had it, the fox then had it, and then the crow has stolen it back. He has restolen it and has gone home to England and will steal the throne of England. And it's actually the fox's cheese. And But, you know, then again, you say, but hang on, it was stolen in the first place. There's so many layers of argument going on here.
And that's the thing. I think they would have, again, being visually literate and understanding these sorts of moral tales in an environment like a monastery. I mean, let's say this was being made in and around St. Augustine's in Canterbury, which is one of the theories. They would have been literate enough to understand that these symbols have these texts associated with them, and that they can play a sort of subliterate level of this story out in the marginalia. But there's things that have been lost to us completely, because that's one that we can sort of access. There's a really interesting scene, isn't there, where you have a monk, looks like he's touching the face or possibly slapping the face of a nun. And then in the margin just below, the scene is being recreated, but the figures are naked. And there is an inscription. It sort of suggests that this may have been, this ties in with your work on celebrity, I imagine, that this is a story that was doing the rounds, that people, if they'd had their OK magazines in the year 1070, this was the sort of, you know, scandalous story that may have been in that. But it's left this echo on the tapestry. And I find it really interesting, this idea of showing them clothed and naked, using the difference between the body of the tapestry and the margin.
Yeah. Yeah. And this person, this woman, is she's called Elifkifu, which unfortunately is a really common name at this point in history. And there are loads of Elifkifus. And
it's such an attractive name. It's so easy
it's
to
lovely.
Say.
it means elf gift, which is nice, I think.
Elf gift,
But
it is a lovely name. But yeah, so you've looked into this then, and because it's so common, it's difficult to find out who it is, isn't it?
Well, I mean, lots of scholars have had a go, and there are sort of two primary ones that I think there's Ethelred the Unready's wife, Elfgiva of York, I think she is, and then the other one is Elfgiva of Northampton, I think, and she's married to Knut. And you sort of, this is, you know, even if it is those women, that's 50 years ago, that story, the beginning of the 1000s. And yet there she is on the tapestry as a sort of running joke that people are meant to sort of go, oh yeah, we know that story. And one of the stories about, you know, one of the stories about Elfgiva of Knut, I think, is that she had perhaps cheated him by having children with other men and then saying they were his sons. So there's a possibility of some sort of scandal, of sex scandal, which is why there's nudity involved, and she slept with another guy. But it's weird that the cleric touching her face, like, you know, why is there a monk touching her face? What's he doing? Is he stroking her? Is he slapping her?
It's very interesting in that, because there's a reproduction of the Bayeux tapestry in Reading Museum, yes, of all places, which is near where I grew up. And in that, it was made, I think it was in the 1890s. It's a Victorian reproduction. And they've not included the genitals.
There's underpants. I love it. It's such a wonderful Victorian thing. It's, you can have this sort of tremendous scene of violence at the Bayeux tapestry where men are being beheaded, but you can't see penises.
God no, cover them up with a nice pair of Victorian underpants.
There are so many phallacies on display in this tapestry. You know, there's one, I posted a Twitter photo yesterday of it. There's a guy squatting down and he's got an enormous penis. It is down to his knees. It is half of his torso is sort of penis. And you just sort of
it's manly, Greg. It's all about manly prowess. Come on, that's what this tapestry is about.
But that's the thing, is like, you know, is that undermining what you're seeing? Is that an ironic comment? Is this satire? Is this medieval satire saying all of the stuff you see above here is just blokes with their cocks out being macho? Or is it some religious allegory to the sin of lust and nudity? Or is it some reference to Adam being naked before Eve turns up? You know, what is going on with these representations? Or is it just literally some nuns drawing a cock going,
This is it. I like to think myself into the minds of the nuns who are actually stitching this thing. And the idea that they've just been conquered and oppressed. And let's be honest, the way that the Normans go about conquering is pretty brutal. There's castles popping up everywhere. There's new monastic complexes that look like castles. And And there is a wholesale replacement of the upper strata of society.
Yeah.
All the lords, all the bishops, everyone's replaced with Normans. So this is a full on, we could make comparisons to dictatorships, couldn't we? It's just, it's an absolute coup. It's turned everything upside down. And then these artists, these women who've inherited generations of the skill of Opus Anglicanum, are being set to work to tell this story about how brilliant the people are who've come over and conquered them. So I cannot help but think that there are going to be subtle messages creeping in in that process.
Some of the messages are pro-William, some of them are pro-Harold. I mean, so, you know, another one of the Aesop fables, I've just had a look at it quickly, is The Stag and the Lion, which is a really quick one, which is basically a stag is being chased by a pack of dogs. It runs into a cave and thinks it's safe. But what is in the cave? A lion, and it eats it. And we see that stag and the lion being chased underneath the scene where Harold has apparently crash-landed in Ponthieu, wrong place in France. And he's been captured by Guy de Ponthieu, who has taken him hostage and stripped him of his sword and his belt, which is a huge humiliation because a man of his status would never be stripped of your belt. And underneath this scene, you see the hounds chasing the stag. And where is the stag running towards? He's running towards the lion, thinking he's safe. And who is the lion? Well, it's William. William the Conqueror turns up. He hears that Harold has been captured. He turns up and he organizes for his freedom, brings him back to Normandy, and has essentially ensnared him in his cave. And he's going to do it in a much more cunning way. He's going to make him swear an oath on a holy relic. But this Aesop fable tells the story of, you know, you're running from danger and you run basically out of the frying pan and into the fire. You run from one dangerous beast into the mouth of another one. So there are lots of these little stories. There's the wolf and the lamb in there, which is about the wolf comes up to a lamb in the river and says, I want to eat you, but I'm going to try and find a justification for doing it. Tries to find lots of reasons. And each time the lamb says, well, no, I didn't do that. I didn't muddy your pool. I didn't, you know, I'm not related to your brother. I'm not any of these things. In the end, the wolf just goes, fine, I'm going to eat you anyway.
Just because I want to, yeah. I mean, these are such amazing insights that you're giving, Greg. I'm so pleased that you're bringing all these secret bits into it, because it brings the tapestry to life. And I think it makes it a much more complex and exciting artwork. Yeah. One of the things I find really exciting, it is such an unusual format. You mentioned earlier, you know, we tend to think of tapestries, although this is not a tapestry, we must stress again, it's an important thing. But we tend to think of tapestries as wall hangings, functional things, you know, they decorate the place, but they also keep warmth in. But this is a frieze in many ways. And what's interesting is that there's this lost hanging of the warrior Byrhtnoth.
Yes.
Famous recorded from the Battle of Maldon poem, the old English poem, and the Battle of Maldon in 991. Now, there's a report that his widow gave a tapestry that recorded his deeds to Ely Cathedral to sort of commemorate it, and that this could have become, in a way, a blueprint for celebrating battle. And I find that really interesting that, as with everything novel and oppressive that the Normans are doing in Anglo-Saxon England, they're doing that age-old tradition of also looking to native traditions and thinking, right, what can we take on board ourselves?
Yeah.
What can we, you know, harness to secure our legitimacy? It's very possible that there was this tradition of kind of these sorts of battle friezes that Odo thinks, right, we'll have one of those made for us in that case. So again, I just think it's all about innovation, but it's also about tradition. It's an amazing thing. And for every tapestry like this that's survived, think about the hundreds that have been lost, all the evidence that's been lost. I think we're lucky to have it, aren't we?
We are lucky, and perhaps the fact that it was housed in France is why it's preserved, and as we said before, you know, we're lucky it didn't get destroyed in the French Revolution. I think you're right about Odo. I think it's really interesting that he obviously comes across, he's installed in Kent. Another reason we think it Odo's paid for it is that there are two other men named in the tapestry called Vidard and Vidal, I think. And both of them are found in the Domesday Book and are tenants of Odo in Kent. So there are two named figures in this tapestry who seem to have an association with Odo in Kent. They seem to have been rewarded for their conduct in the Battle of Hastings. They've done some great thing, perhaps, on the battlefield. They've been given some land, and they turn up in this tapestry. So that's again suggests that Odo has commissioned it. But you're absolutely right. He has commissioned an English artistic representation of a Norman victory. And maybe it's trying to play nice with the locals. He's trying to sort of get them to, you know, endorse it. Maybe it's simply that the, you know, he's going for where the best artists are, and he knows the best artists in Canterbury. You know, the Normans are, they're great builders. They're architects of renown. But I wouldn't necessarily say they're the world's greatest tapestry makers.
Artists.
No, they're not renowned for that, are they?
Not, you know, the fine arts. I mean, that's the thing. The Anglo-Saxons, by this stage, that was one of the big selling points of going over to England and grabbing England, was its rich culture and it was very rich in lots of things, wasn't it, in its legal structure, but
and its tax economy, you know, it's a very
good tax haven.
Yeah, it's very wealthy, you know, it's got a really well-regulated economy, it's got excellent administration and bureaucracy, it's a sort of beautifully centralized system, and the Normans basically hijack it. Turn up and go, right, we're having that, and they kind of just go, yeah, carry on as before, lads, but I'm your new king.
Just and with I, us.
Yeah, I've built a castle in the garden.
Exactly. It is brutal. I think there's a reason that school children are taught about 1066, and it's because it is this massive moment, but it's a moment in English history. I did a podcast with Peter Frankpan, who says, 1066 on a world scale is absolutely nothing. And he's right. But for sort of this sort of native tradition, it does transform the complexion of the British Isles, you know, beyond recognition. It transforms the landscape, it transforms the art. I mean, you could call the Bay of Tapestry the last Anglo-Saxon artwork, the last known great Anglo-Saxon artwork. And I think that's another reason why I love it so much.
It's really interesting. I'm a good friend of Peter, and I agree with him on the kind of, we get very obsessed with Englishness and Eurocentricism, and he's right that meanwhile the rest of the world is doing many greater things. But I would quibble a little bit on that, because I think Tapestry is really interesting because it depicts the end of an age, not just that. What's interesting about Tapestry is it's missing a whole third of the story, which is the Viking invasion of Harald Hardrada joined by Tostig, and Tostig is Harald Godwinson's brother. And there is no reference to that at all in the Tapestry, which again is perhaps indicative of a Norman bent. You know, the Normans don't care about the Viking invasion because it failed. But what's so interesting about the Viking invasion is that it's often written about by historians as the end of the Viking era. So dramatic was the failure, so catastrophic were the losses. You know, they come over with 300 ships. They go home with 24 ships. You've got a 90% fatality rate in the Viking army. But it's often heralded as the end of the Viking age and the end, of course, of the Saxon age. So in the space of a month, you've gone from having an English king, then a Norwegian invader. Suddenly a Norman turns up, deposes, you know, both of them, and there's a whole new regime in charge. And in some ways, you could say that the early Middle Ages have ended, and here is a new start.
You make that point about the end of the Viking Age. It is so important that their absence from this narrative is so poignant, because they have reached their end in many ways. And when we think about the reach of the Vikings, how far their influence spread, you know, from Constantinople right over to Newfoundland and Russia, and that is a cultural group, a society that had such a profound effect on such a large amount of the inhabited world, and it's over, it's snuffed out, and what we're replaced with is this Romanesque, this Western Europe that the Normans come to characterize, and then that sets the tone for another couple of hundred years of history in many ways in Western Europe, certainly.
Because then, of course, the Norman lands in France, and you end up with the Plantagenets and the Angevin, and the kind of 100 Years' War.
And the Holy Roman Empire, and it spreads down to Spain. We can carry the narrative on, but that's going to have to be another podcast, Greg, because we have talked for an epically long time.
We haven't even done the arrow in the eye.
Oh, my gosh. Well, we should, shouldn't we? Should we just quickly do the arrow in the eye? It's very not. Quick. It didn't happen, did it? Let's say that it's possibly... that we've always thought that Harald is the figure that has the arrow piercing his eye. But in fact, it's probably not. It's probably the character collapsing to the right of him, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, very quickly, the word Harold is over the man in the eye. So you could say, okay, that's him. But the verb interfectus est, is killed in Latin, is over the man who's being sliced through the leg, falling backwards. And we know in the earliest contemporary source, really, is the Carmen de Hastinga Poelio, Song of the Battle of Hastings by Guy Damiens. And it talks not about an arrow in the eye, but about him being mobbed by Eustace of Boulogne and William and a couple of others. And they basically hack him to pieces. They cut off his legs. They cut off his genitals. They stab him in the stomach. You know, the violence of his death in the earliest sources is nothing to do with an eye or an arrow. It's to do with being, you know, sliced horribly and
Greg,
mutilated.
Greg, could you just say that? Could you say that last line again? Because it just cut out. The violence of his death.
Sorry. So the violence of his death in the contemporary source, the earliest contemporary source, that Carmen de Hastinga Poelio, is not about archery or an arrow in the eye. It's about mutilation, being sliced through the leg, through the stomach. His genitals are cut off. He is mobbed by William's men and William himself, and is horribly slaughtered. Whereas, of course, an arrow from a distance is sort of an ignoble death for a king.
Exactly. But it's also connected with this idea of him being a perjurer as well, isn't it?
That
this arrow may have been... There's a fascinating bit of evidence that in an earlier image of the tapestry dating from the 18th century, there is no arrow there. That the arrow seems to have been added in later. With a different thread, so that it might have been added in again as a sort of additional level of ignominy to add to Harold that he was a perjurer, because this was the suitable for somebody who has broken their word, isn't it?
Because in there's the Old Testament story of King Zedekiah and his sons who are punished for basically breaking an oath of loyalty to their lord, and Zedekiah is blinded, his sons are beheaded. So there is this idea that being blinded is your punishment for breaking your word. And we've seen in the tapestry an oath being broken by Harold. But as you say, it's probably a later restoration. And this is something we haven't said, actually. The tapestry has been restored heavily, and there are lots of bits in it that are actually, fortunately, not original. And it's hard to know quite what was there beforehand. But it looks like maybe Harold, for me, is probably the man on the floor being horribly sliced to death rather than arrow in the eye. But of course, arrow in the eye is a pretty timeless death, and it's gone down in history as one of the great things that anyone knows about this tapestry. So
it's amazing, isn't it? I love the idea that for centuries we've been saying Harold Godwinson and sharing this image of a man with an arrow, and Harold's actually lying on the floor behind going, actually, mate, it's me over here.
That's Steve with the arrow in the eye.
That's Steve. How come Steve gets all the glory?
That's the real problem. I mean, the interesting thing about the tapestry is that we see the key characters, William and Harold, and Edward the Confessor, of course. Edward is very distinctive because he's bearded. But these characters, because they're drawn by different artists, they're embroidered by different artists, they change colour and they change clothing and they change horses. Their horses are black, then they're white, then they're grey. So there's a sort of problem in continuity where you can't always necessarily go, here's Harold, he looks, you know, it's not like Bart Simpson always looks the same in every scene. Harold changes clothes, he changes his look throughout, and you have to sort of try and keep up by using the naming orthography above his name, or by trying to work out, is he central to this scene? But it's not
always
clear.
And yet again, it's the combination of text and image, isn't it? And it's, again, one of these things that makes it such a dense object to study. You know, you need to be able to understand the Latin. You need to understand the relationship between the main images and the marginalia. It's just endlessly fascinating. Greg, we could carry on talking about this all day. I might have to we might have to finish this conversation, you know, another day. But we've covered so very much. We must sign off. I have really enjoyed talking to you. You're brilliant to follow on Twitter. And if people want to follow you, what's your Twitter handle?
It's @Greg_Jenner.
It's that cheeky underscore has to come in. Yeah,
absolutely.
He's amazing. And I love everything you do. You know, your bits for the Versailles series are amazing. I can't wait for the celebrity book to come out. And I've got to wait 3 years. Not fair. But good luck with writing that. I hope you've enjoyed this, Art Detective listeners. If you want to follow me, I'm on Twitter as Dr. Yanina Ramirez. And if you want to subscribe, you could go to historyhit.com/artdetective. There'll be lots of wonderful guests coming up, particularly in the month of June. We have a bumper crop. But Greg, honestly, so grateful. It's been wonderful. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.